Hi, it's Simon Smart with you. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Well, today I'm bringing you the second part of my interview with Peter Hitchens, who is a conservative columnist and author from the UK. He's well known in his own right, but also as the younger brother of the late Christopher Hitchens, who was a commentator, writer, and public intellectual who, before his death in 2011, was a prominent and vocal atheist. Peter Hitchens wrote a book called The Rage Against God, How Atheism Led Me to Faith, and this was a response to his brother Christopher's book, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Peter Hitchens was in Australia for the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. I caught up with him in his hotel lobby. It was a bit noisy, but we got through a really long and interesting chat. In this part of the interview, we talk about his conversion from atheism to Christianity, and he makes a big point of the fact that he believes that coming to faith is essentially a choice. I hope you enjoy the interview. In your book about faith, you talk about having been an atheist but making a gradual, hesitant, sometimes reluctant,
very reluctant
journey back to Christian belief. And you acknowledge that belief is to some extent a choice. Why is it better to choose belief?
Well, it's better to choose belief for the reasons that I choose it. First of all, because there doesn't seem to be any doubt in my mind that on a simple practical basis, once you've decided that there is justice in the universe, then you behave in different ways, you expect different things than otherwise. And in making that choice, you by desiring justice to be visited on others, you place yourself under the authority of that justice. And it's a bargain, if you like. I don't want to make it out to be particularly pious. I'm not a particularly good person, and nor would anybody who knows me well say that I was. That's not my claim. What the great advantage of this belief is that even people who aren't very nice benefit from it. Those people who have to deal with people who aren't very nice benefit from it. It changes, as I say, the whole order of the universe. If you choose the other thing, and there are only two choices here once you've decided to choose, and of course a lot of people prefer not to, you either choose a universe that is created orderly and purposeful, and therefore you have to do all that you can to discover the purpose, both through scientific endeavor and through attempts to understand the scientific endeavors of others, and through the endless battle to discover what the law is. And I use the law in the widest possible sense. If this universe is governed by laws, then everything about it will be governed by laws, many of which will be inaccessible to us because they would have been created by a mind which is so much greater than ours that we can't. But to some extent, it is accessible. So the discovery of the laws is the first task, followed by an attempt to abide by them at the second. It's pretty much absorbs all the activity that you and thought that you're capable of. If you decide instead that the universe is a cosmic car crash, an accident of no significance, then none of your actions has any significance beyond its immediate observable effects. There is no justice. You can expect none, seek none. You're bound to live to your own advantage according to sort of the highest law to which you can aspire is the golden rule, with all the faults we've discussed. And what is there to discover? I'm always amused when declared atheists, and they are declared, they've chosen this. The universe is a chaos, it means nothing has any origin. When they start going on about the beauty of this and the wonder of that, well, what is the beauty? Why is it beautiful? Surely the whole point about beauty and the reason why it is beautiful is that it expresses truth. If there's no truth being expressed, then it's just a random collection of objects. If you think it's beautiful, it's a subjective feeling in you that has no significance. Just as how can a non-religious person have a conscience? For all you know, it's your bile duct. Unless there is a law, unless there is a purpose, none of these things can be given that significance. And the word beauty seems to me to be denied to you. You can't have it.
You are very honest in your book about your own failings.
No, I'm not. I keep most of them to myself, and I intend to carry on doing so.
It's not lurid, but you speak quite candidly about being your failures, and you're contrasting your conversion life to now, but also
not very nice now. Imagine what it was like before.
Yeah, is there something of beauty in that transition though?
Not to me. No, I wouldn't. I apply beauty to music, which seems to me to be, and there's a wonderful passage in Ecclesiasticus, in the Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, where the composers of music are said to have found out musical tunes, which I always think is exactly what they've done. They were there before, but Johann Sebastian Bach found them.
Yes. There's a sense in which those sorts of descriptions that you've just made don't seem to make any sense in a thoroughly materialistic world.
Well, they do. They make no sense. They don't make any. And this is why you have to ask, what is this passion which makes somebody want there not to be a God? And this is, there are so many of the modern atheists are just dismissive of belief. And there is this, I mentioned him in the book, and I'll mention him again here, the American atheist philosopher Thomas Nagel is very honest about this. I do inquire very often, why is it that I so much want there not to be a God? He accepts, as so few atheists do, that there might be motivation in his choice, and therefore that there might be choice, that it is possible to choose.
There's a sort of a willful disbelief.
The default position of any thinking person, and the state of scientific knowledge that we have now, is that you look at the universe, there is absolutely no definitive answer to the question, is there a God? The default position has to be agnosticism. The decision to believe has to be taken as an act of will, and in my view, as an act of desire. Either you desire that there is a God and you then seek him, or you desire that there is no God and you do all that you can to stamp out the belief that there is one, because it threatens everything that you wish to live by. Now, why? Why do people choose this thing? Why do people so anxiously and deliberately and ferociously choose this belief? And yet when you ask them, they always claim it's not a choice. They will very frequently say, I cannot believe. You could believe tomorrow afternoon if you wanted to. You could believe in 5 minutes. All you need to do is say that you do, that is, and live as if you do. Nothing else is involved. There's no swoons or trances, or you don't light anything, or set fire to anything, or lie down on anything, or lie down in front of anything. You just have to say, this is my choice. The universe is ordered and purposeful. And that's it. It's much easier to do that than even to become a Muslim, where you just have to make a very brief declaration. It's all you need to do. It doesn't require, you're not required to renounce any intellectual respectability. There's nothing in what we know of the universe which rules that possibility out. And so all you need to do is do it. And yet they say, I can't. What they mean when they say I can't is exactly what children mean when they say I can't. It's me, I won't.
I won't.
Shan't, but always dressed up as can't.
As someone who once was a non-believer, it's probably not all that mysterious to you.
It's not mysterious to me at all. I know exactly why they do it. And when I tell them so, I'm always amused at this apoplectic rage they get into when you point out that it might conceivably be because it suits them very nicely.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. We're halfway through an interview with Peter Hitchens, the conservative columnist from the UK, Christian believer and brother of the well-known atheist Christopher Hitchens. Now, there's a lovely line in your book about faith being best explained in poetry rather than argument. Is that, in a sense, how you experienced that shift?
Yes, I think so. Poetry, art, music. Architecture, for me, above all things, which that one of the arts which is working most constantly, I was working on is where we sit now in this rather hideous building, in which there is absolutely no evidence of the numinous at all. But it's always working on you, and of course it says things which go beyond words. Words are a tremendously limited form of communication, but the great thing is they're quite easy to understand, but they simplify things and bring them down. One of the things about poetry is that we don't really understand when some line or other suddenly gets us. We don't really understand why. If you just set it down and examined it, if you took, for instance, the lines, the woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. And set them down on a piece of paper and went over them again and again and again. So why is this so moving? If you'd spent enough time on it, you'd have completely destroyed it as a work of art, and you would understand nothing more than you did by just hearing it. But why, I can't tell you.
It certainly points towards something beyond the material.
Well, I don't know about beyond. I'm not at all sure about this beyond. That's what I say about this, the finding out of musical tunes. It's here, it's in the material world. The material world is itself a miracle, much of which we have yet to discover. And for thousands of years, we didn't know that the waves along which we send television signals and radio signals were all around us, for instance. We didn't know they were there. We didn't know we could fly. The theory of flight was a discovery of something which had always been the case. How much else about nature do we not know, which we would regard as miraculous if it were revealed to us? I have no idea. But to separate the material from poetry seems to me to be a mistake. There is something about it. It is material. It's just we don't have a language capable of fully expressing it. And yet, as I said, it catches in the emotions. And what are the emotions? And they're material, if you like. They certainly form part of the material world. They can close your throat and stop you talking and bring tears to your eyes in a very material way. So I think it's difficult to set the limits of the material world too narrowly.
You have seen and experienced cultures that have kind of banished God from their society, and that's something you fear is happening in the West. Well, it is happening in the West.
Well, I don't fear it. I mean, I observe it. It's quite extraordinary how many of the things going on, and particularly in my own country, are. I came back from. Well, I went to live in the Soviet Union for 2.5 years, 1990 to 1992. I then went to live in the United States for another 2 years. So really, when I came back, I'd been away from my own country for five years. And I don't know whether you've done this. It's an odd thing. It's like, much like not seeing a beloved friend or relative for a long time, and then suddenly seeing them again afresh. And sometimes they will have aged or become ill while you've been away. And it's very noticeable in a way which it wouldn't have been if you'd been there all the time. And I was constantly, almost every day, struck by strange flashes of recognition in the England to which I return. And where does this remind me of? Well, it certainly doesn't remind me of the England I left 5 years ago. And then it would come to me, it reminded me of the Soviet Union, of all things. And yet it did, again and again, because the thing about the Soviet Union, people don't, they think, of course, that the Soviet experiment was all about economics and the nationalization of everything. And KGB repression. Of course, all those things were there and present, and it took place in Russia, which is a country in which it's a low-temperature laboratory in which all kinds of things happen rather differently from the way they'd happen in a gentler place. But the other thing that was going on was an immense assault upon the human family and upon independence of mind. And those were the things that I found. The intelligent revolutionaries cast aside, as long ago as the 1920s, Antonio Gramsci was casting aside, he went to the Soviet Union. So this will never, ever succeed in advanced, civilized Christian countries. It just can't be done, and no one wanted it done anyway. Let's look for a different approach. And the intelligent revolutionaries long ago cast aside the Soviet model, but they still have many of the same aims. As I try to point out in The Rage Against God, in the quotations from the Sidney and Beatrice Webb's extraordinary book about the Soviet Union, for instance, and other aspects of it, that it was many of the things which they said and thought and desired are the same things which the new atheists say and think they desire. And this is one of the things I wrote in that book, which has been most violently rejected by many of its more unsympathetic critics. And I tell them, it's absolutely true. I've seen them both. I know them both from the inside. The parallels are astonishing.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed that interview with Peter Hitchens. If you'd like to hear more of that, you can go to the Centre for Public Christianity website, where there'll also be an added part of the interview where Peter Hitchens talks about his relationship with his brother, Christopher. I'll see you next time.